Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Simon Barrett, and welcome to another edition of The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone from the entertainment world. My guest today is a gifted musician and a fabulous actor. Fans may well remember him as the evil Murdoch, a deliciously despicable evil mastermind from the TV show MacGyver. It is my great pleasure to welcome Michael DeBar to
Hi,
the
everyone.
Program.
How are you doing? Thank you, Simon. Thank you so much. It's great to be able to talk to you. I love the word despicus. I think we should use that for the entire interview. Delicious. And
absolutely. I'm with you on that one. Michael, as
yes.
No doubt you have spotted, I was born in the UK.
Yeah.
And my mother was insistent when I was little that I was respectful to my fellow man. I believe that your full name is the Marquis Michael Philip de Bauer. So my question is, should I call you Lord de Bauer, sir, or merely my lord?
Why don't you just call me Kate Middleton? You know, and pretend that I'm the future Queen of England. Oh, no, sorry, Elton's got that, hasn't he? I'm second. No, dude, you know, it's an 800-year-old title. It was handed down for centuries ago to my ancestor, and it means absolutely nothing. In fact, if you're a singer in a rock band, you get a table in a good restaurant quicker than you do if you're a marquee. I you know, the only reason that people bring it up is because I can't avoid it. You know, there it is. It's a fact. But the true fact is that I was educated in those kind of that world, that boarding school world, which was half Dickens, half Dante, and all disgusting. I mean, I loathe the class system. That's why I live in America, because I adore America. America is a system that's built on hard work and opportunity, and that creates, you know, the hierarchy. If you work hard, then you're rewarded for it. In England, the aristocracy is merely something you inherit, like migraines or herpes. And, I'm not interested in any of that. But the fact is that I am one. And, but I'd rather be born into a Muddy Waters family than into the royal family.
Actually, that's a good way to segue into the next question. Why don't we start with a little bit of biography? Tell us a bit about yourself.
Well, you know, I was born in England. When I was 8 years old, I went to these torturous schools where I had an incredible education. My mother was, shall we say, mentally challenged. I think she was diagnosed as schizophrenic. My father was a wastrel and a decadent man, and I never really knew either of them very well, but I was put down to these schools when I was 1 year old because of, you know, the title of blah, 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 blah. And I learned an awful lot. I didn't have a connection with my parents because my father was in jail for most of my childhood and my mother was in an institution. So I was raised, shall we say, by my mother's side of the family. But at eight, gone, boarding school. And I developed very early such a connection to American rock and roll music, primarily the blues. When I first heard the blues, I realized that was, you know, my reason for living, to be perfectly frank. I knew that I had a connection to it that transcended wanting to do anything else. And music and the arts, you know, raised their head very early on, Simon. So by the time I left school at 16, I was out on my own, and I went to drama school. And while I was in drama school, I got this movie, To Sell with Love, which some of your listeners might be familiar with. It starred Sidney Poitier, and it was about a bunch of delinquent British kids. And
Indeed. And
Sidney taught them how to, you know, be, you know, responsible and loving, and it was a fantastic movie. It was also hugely successful, and it was at a time that some of your listeners might want to know about, which was the late 60s in London, which was paradise for anybody that loved music, clothes, fashion, and changing the world. It was a cultural revolution, as you all know, of course, with the advent of the Beatles and the Stones and so on, the Doors, Zeppelin, etc., Hendrix.
I'll tell you what. I'm not trying to, cut you short here. Obviously, you love the late 60s era. That probably is where the title of your new CD comes from, Carnaby Street. Would you mind terribly if we played a track like the title track?
Well, I'd love you to. And, you know, it is autobiographical, but it's not a look back. It's a recreation, so people that love that era can experience it now. My album has got nothing to do with retroness. It's just bringing the experience of those feelings of new excitement and passion for a new world. And if you listen to the lyrics while you're nodding your head, that'd be fantastic. It's the title track of my album, Carnaby Street.
Right, and here it is. And I love the quote about velvet trousers.
Well, it's
It's just a glorious track. I mean, in some ways, you know, it's a trip down memory lane, yet it's not. You know, it's something new and fresh. You know, you don't have to be old like I am to appreciate it.
I tell you what's new and fresh. What's new and fresh is enthusiasm and joy. The majority of stuff that we listen to in terms of rock and roll is either aggressive, submissive, ironic, or apologetic. Unfortunately, I think that the notion of... can I use offensive language?
Mm-hmm. Oh, rock and roll is
rock and roll is a synonym for fucking. This thought has been lost, I think, on the last few generations of rock and roll musicians, in that there seems to be tremendous anger. Now, there's always anger, sympathy for the devil, the street fighting man. Of course, Jim Morrison railing against everything, and that was wonderful. But now there's a certain apology in rock and roll, and I guess what people are relating to in this album is just the joy of it. The love of it, the sex of it, the fun of it, the fact that life, as you said earlier in our preamble, if you don't have a sense of humor, you're going to be in trouble, and you're going to have to, you know, reach for that Wellbutrin, that Prozac, that antidepressant, which is why I wrote a song on the album called "You're My Pain Killer," which means that love is the ultimate antidepressant, you know, and I think that has been forgotten. I think that the idea that, you know, the heart of rock and roll beats below your waist.
I'm going to come to my painkiller in a little while, but a question for you: who else is in the band?
Who are the miscreants? Well, they are miscreants, and they're incredibly talented miscreants. You know, I'll go through it very quickly for you. Paul Eel is my partner. He's a bass player. He is a bass player of great renown on many records, Courtney Love records, Juliette Lewis records, Tina Turner records. And he is the bass player for Linda Perry. Linda Perry is a very popular and commercial, successful producer of many different acts, incredible writer and producer. And he is the bass player that she uses. Our drummer is David Goodstein, who is played with a myriad of different entities. Very funky, very, you know, it's like Ricky Martin to, you know, Stone Temple Pilots. You know, I mean, it's just a very, very eclectic musician. Kevin Bruni on keyboards was just on tour with Fiona Apple. Played with Michelle Mingello, was in Johnny Rotten's John Lydon's PIL. And Eric Skirmhorn, our guitar player, a fantastic guitar player, was with Iggy for like 5 years and provides that brutal, supple power that he's got. So they're all very, very accomplished musicians who've played with a lot of different people. The reason that we gelled is because we all have the same frame of reference, and that is we'd rather be Little Richard than Little Wayne.
Okay, so could I take that as the answer to my next question, which was going to be, you know, it's been quite a while since you released a CD. You know, what brought Carnaby Street on?
Well, you know, that's a fantastic question, Simon. Thank you for asking it. And music and rock and roll has never left me. Just because I kill handsome men on television doesn't mean that I wasn't playing in clubs. You know, I've been killing people for 25 years on American television, you know, and loving every second of it. But that didn't mean that it excluded me from playing music. What it did exclude me from was the time to put a band together. What happened to me was kind of weird. You know, I came along in 72 in a glam rock band. I then went into the world of Led Zeppelin and was with a band called Detective. And then I was with Jonesy from the Pistols in the Checkered Pass. And then I joined the Power Station and replaced Robert Palmer. So I had an incredible experience in rock and roll. And in the middle 80s, I wanted to act again. You know, I'd achieved something. I'd written a few hits for people. I was in a private jet with John and Andy Taylor at the peak of that fame. And I was offered this role of this killer in MacGyver, and I took it. And it turned into a six-year gig, you know, and that turned into other things. So I got off on a tangent in terms of acting. But I always played guitar, and I always went and sang with bands, whoever was in town, you know, I would sing, or whatever location I happened to be in. If I was in, you know, Mobile, Alabama, I'd go and play with a blues band in a nightclub. I mean, I still play. But about 3 years ago, I suffered a really bad crash accident, and I went down to Austin, Texas to recuperate, and part of my recuperation, I fucked up my right arm, and I had to learn how to play guitar again as a kind of a physical therapy, and I was down there writing kind of poetry, writing how I was feeling in this transition in my life, and I met a whole bunch of incredibly authentic blues musicians and country musicians, and it reminded me, and it inspired me as I was inspired on the streets of London in late 60s, and I thought, I have to make a record, and I started to write, and then I came back to L.A. when I was physically better, and I put this band together with these guys who I'd seen around playing with people and loved, and said, let's get in a room and play this couple of tunes and see what happens. And within half an hour, you know, I had a big smile on our faces, and hence, here's the album.
I think it's simply splendid. I mean, the album,
so much.
The album rocks.
Yeah. It does.
Now, I am going to change gears completely.
Yeah.
Gears, interesting use of the word. I was looking at your website, which is debar.com, and for people that don't do French, it's actually DESBARRES.com. Anyway, I was looking at the site a couple of days ago, and I just couldn't help but notice the picture of you standing by a car, decked out in not quite normal, you know, paint jobs by Ford or GM. Right. I mean, you know, it's not every day that you see a car that has the Union Jack on it.
That's true.
Right. And I've got to admit that I became a little obsessed.
Yeah.
I was thinking to myself, okay, he's a Brit. It has to be a Brit car.
Yeah.
And I went digging around, and I thought it was a Jag, and then I thought it was a Lotus, but I couldn't quite match up the headlights. What the hell is it?
Well, what makes you think it's not a Jag?
Well, I couldn't find a Jag that had that headlight arrangement.
Well, are you familiar with are you a car guy?
No.
Well, that's what it is, and it's you know, obviously I had it sort of somewhat customized.
Somewhat customized.
But I have several vehicles. I love adventurous cars, and people have been very generous to me over the years, and I've assembled quite a collection. You know.
So exactly, what Jag is it?
Well, you know, do you really want to talk? my God.
I love
yes,
it.
I do.
It bothers me because I couldn't.
It's a customized E-Type from the 60s. But it's just got a different engine and so on. So to give it a name or a type, there really isn't one, because it's such a mishmash of different bits and pieces. But essentially, it's an E-Type Jag.
You know, when I first saw it, I went E-Type, but I've never seen an E-Type that looked like that.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, you know, I have peculiar tastes, you know, and God is good. I can indulge them.
But I love it. Yes,
it's very pretty. Very, very, you know, obviously, I mean, it creates havoc wherever I go, so I don't really go for it. I don't really use it that much.
Right, that was going to be my next question. Did you actually drive it around?
No, I just sit in parking lots. Yeah, I just sit in parking lots and wait for people to, you know, recognize me.
All right. Well, that's perfect. Okay.
And if you believe that, I got some swampland to tell you.
I'm in Mississippi, so Florida's not far away.
How fabulous. I love down south. I love it. I love down south. You know, I've always had the best experiences in the hot and sticky south.
I'll tell you what. Do you want to do something wild and crazy?
No, of course not. Me?
Well,
and obviously, you haven't read the ex-wife's books. Sure, wild and crazy is good. What would you like to do?
Well, we have a caller on the line. Would you like to field a question?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Caller from the 63 area code, what's your name and what would you like to ask the Lord?
Yeah. You'll have to translate, Simon. I can't hear the gentleman.
No, neither can I. I guess.
Maybe technically we could work on that. But I'd be delighted to answer any questions, you know, that anybody has to ask. If you can get it, you get some volume on him, that'd be fantastic.
Yep. We'll come back to him. Okay, let's date ourselves. You and I are no longer in our 20s. In fact, I think you have a couple of years on me.
I'm 64. The age thing is an interesting subject, which, you know, I have a lot of thoughts about. I have been sober off drugs, and I was a heroin addict for many years. I've been sober off drugs and alcohol and pills of any kind for 31 years. So I subscribe that, and the desire for health and physical, athleticism to be my new obsession. of all of the ugly stuff. And at first, I did it because of narcissism and vanity, you know. But it actually became very clear to me that I was really more into that because of the people around me. I mean, there's many people I love in my life. I have a beautiful collection of friends and family and my son. And it seemed absolutely inane to punish myself in that way. So, longevity, I don't think about age that much. I think about enthusiasm, and I think about energy, and I think about staying in this moment right here, right now. And I don't really go backwards, you know. I'm not a sentimentalist. I have no nostalgia. That's why I have no sense of nostalgia. You know, I'd lived here for over half my life. If I see a movie and there's a bus at Trafalgar Square and cobblestones in Prince William, and I don't get pangs of regret, or, you know, I don't feel like that, because I really try and stay with what's in front of me, and that's what enabled me, I think, to last this long. I mean, the fact that I'm making a rock and roll record in my 60s, I think, you know, is not a testament to anything other than just the joy of it. You know, so the age thing is a trap for a lot of people, because when you say we're not in our 20s, I'd rather say what I am rather than what I'm not. I'd rather live a life that, about, you know, for what I stand for rather than what I stand against. You know, I don't characterize myself by what I've been. I characterize myself by what I am, if that answers your question.
In some ways it does, but I'll press on, because
sure,
that's my job.
Yes,
you do. In 1967, you scored a part in the Sydney Poitier Classic, To Sir With Love. By today's standards, or lack of them, To Sir With Love, it seems quite blah, but at the time, it was quite controversial. It switched some normal racial roles. What was it like to be part of that?
Well, very simply put, Sidney Poitier remains the most noble, charismatic man I've ever met, and to this day. And I've met a lot of people that others would consider honorable and, great influences on the culture and our world. He, I think, at a very critical time in my life, I was only 16 when I worked with him, and he set a template for the joy of the profession, the technique of the profession, the brilliance and responsibility that you have as an artist if you're at a certain level to the people around you. Obviously, he was an African-American, and he was the biggest movie star in the world. That year, we had In the Heat of the Night, The Sir With Love, and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, all three of which were, in today's jargon, blockbusters. Made a fortune for the studio. So this guy was, as hard as a pistol. And for us to, you know, live in a very ethnically mixed country, England, for us to see this guy at such a peak of his powers was transformative. And it really did. And already I came to that with a love of African American blues music. So it was an incredible endorsement to me. How bullshit racism and, you know, having judgments about the color of somebody's skin, for Christ's sake. You know, and we all woke up, all of us. I mean, there were a few bigots in those, you know, working class kids who were terrific actors but didn't know shit about life. You know, we all learned a lot from Sydney. And I think that it does have a certain quaintness to it, that movie. But really, it's two things. One, it is a story about a strong African-American man who had a tremendous effect on white kids, somewhat like Jimi Hendrix did. And the fact that it is a very clear and colorful representation of how exciting the late 60s in London was.
You mentioned it earlier. Another track on your CD, You're My Painkiller.
Yeah.
Would you mind terribly if I took it out for a spin?
Oh, no. I'd love you to play it. I'd love to people, your audience, to hear it. That would make me very happy.
Okay. Well, here it is.
You're my painkiller. You're my painkiller. You're my painkiller. You're my painkiller. But when I looked in your eyes, I wasn't me.
Okay, let's be absolutely shamelessly commercial for a moment. Where can people get copies of Carnaby Street?
Very simply, they can go to iTunes, or if you want to download it, or you can order it from Gonzo Multimedia, or you can go to my website, which I'll say very, very slowly how you can get it. This will tell you how to get the album. The website is www.mdb, my initials, mdb, immedia, immedia.com, www.mdbimedia.com. That will tell you exactly how to get the record. iTunes,
oh.
Amazon, it's available everywhere.
I like it. I want a signed copy. Oh, no, that's...
You got it. I'll send you a signed copy with pleasure, Simon.
Okay. I already partially know the answer to this next question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Sure.
Do you have plans on taking the band on the road?
Yes, we just did. My plan is pretty simple. In today's marketplace, the music business does not exist. So therefore, I consider myself completely a new artist. So what I've got to do is, as much as I can, to bring attention to the record that I believe in so much and the band that I believe in so much. So what we're doing is as much television as we can. So, you know, the album's been out, what, like since the 10th, so not long. During that time, we did the Andy Dick as a TV show on the internet, God bless him, and we did that. We intend on doing more television appearances for the next month or two, and then hopefully people will dig it and enjoy the album and come see us play. I anticipate us being on the road in September, late August, starting some shows and seeing what happens. It's a crapshoot, and it's a very exciting time for me, music, right now, because it's an open playing field, you know. There are so many great bands, I think, out there that would not have been heard at all and now can be. I mean, what it does mean is they're not going to sell 25 million copies like Bon Jovi or something in the 80s, but it does mean that they can sustain a life and they can play their music the way they want to play it and not be told how to play it by some corporate, you know, fellas who are simply in there for the dollar. And I'm not naive. I understand that goes on. God knows I spent, you know, many, 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 many years in a myriad of bands going through that corporate struggle. But today, you don't have to. You just do it yourself, man, and you get on the road and you play. You put your records out and you sell them from the trunk of your car. And it's God's will whether you connect with a lot of people or not. And I fully expect to connect with the entire world.
Actually, your last comment reminded me of a good friend of mine, an Americana musician who actually does very well. He did an East Coast tour, and what he did was fill his car up with CDs and just cruise from radio station to radio station.
He
was hugely successful.
Well, sure he was, because he had the balls to do it, and that's what I'm saying, and that's exactly what I'm doing. Because I have a certain kind of cachet in television, I'm going to use whatever it takes to get this record out to people so they can enjoy it and we can play it. I don't have any agenda about this. I just want to play the album, and I will do everything I can, like your friend in his car. You know, the thing about us is that there are five of us, and that means a huge car, which, you know, is fine, and we'll do it. But so I applaud your friend, and I applaud everybody listening who's got the courage to plug in and play, make those CDs and put them out.
Yeah. In fact, another person that is pretty much doing what you're talking about,
yeah,
is oh God, I've forgotten his name. But
we can't do an at-will, can he, Simon?
The
his name,
right? The king of bubblegum pop.
The king of bubblegum in what era? In that, this era? Justin Bieber?
No, in the 60s. But let's move on. Okay,
sure.
I've been quite well behaved up to now, but I have to broach a subject that you probably hate. I'm sure you've been asked a million times. Did you have fun being the bad guy, Murdoch, on the MacGyver show?
Yeah, the thing is that, like, there's nothing in my life that I don't like answering questions about. Or, you know, I am so privileged, you know, to have been able to do what I love to do. And Murdoch especially, because, you know, Murdoch, every time, I only played him like a dozen times over 6 years, but people seem to think that it was more than that. But it was a character who, A, was a master of disguise, therefore I wasn't locked into any particular character. I he was evil, and he wanted to kill Richard. You know, he wanted to kill Richard Ian Anderson, and that was like the only thing that stuck. But it was a fabulous experience. It was great. It was incredible for many reasons, one of which was I got to be really expert at driving and stunt car driving, which I love, and weapons, which I have a particular fondness for, from flamethrowers to, you know, to very specific knives. And I became very adept at both of those things and enjoyed myself tremendously. Worked, you know, 6 years in Vancouver, Canada, which I loved, and got to, you know, have a certain notoriety doing it, which led to other things. I mean, my life has been a series of work hard and keep working hard. You know, work breeds work. So Murdoch is a dear friend of mine, and I think he might be in the spare room. There he is. Yeah, and so for corpse right now, but he looks great. Very happy.
Just out of idle curiosity, do you ever talk to Richard Anderson?
You know, I don't. I have not spoken to him. I adored him. He was fantastic. You know, hugely athletic. You know, great hockey player. And but I have not really you know, kept up my friendship with him. I think it's pretty typical. You know, when you do work so closely with people for such an intense amount of time, and you know, you want to sort of get away from them. You know, you want to get into a new vibe, and I think that's so true of bands. You know, I mean, the majority of bands that stay together, using this analogy, is that they become families, and families kill each other. You know, and you move on, you have that wonderful experience, and you move on.
In some ways, you really are a dichotomy. You're an excellent actor and an excellent musician. Which is your first love?
Well, you know, there's no such thing, is there? I mean, you're either loving or you're not. I mean, you know, I love many things. You know, I think, to answer your question without being too coy or pompous, I'm an artist, and I want to express myself, and that can be in many forms. I mean, I paint, I take photographs, I write books, I write poetry, I act, I sing, I rock, I appreciate other people's music, I go to museums, I love the whole culture of art, both historic art and contemporary art, and, you know, I just get up and do whatever I want to, really, and I always have. I've just been lucky, you know, at being able to do that. But I've worked very, very hard at it, you know. They say that, you know, that the majority of roles that one plays, you know, is making, shall we say, not terrific material into something that's watchable. You know, I can count on one hand the things that I'm actually proud of, but both in terms of movies and television and, you know, albums, you know, or songs, you know. I mean, there's only a handful of things that I really think, well, that's good, you know. I think if you think anything else, you just get fat and indulgent and get this false sense of your own brilliance and grandiosity. And, oh, man, I've been kicked to the curb so many times, you know, too. You know, I've had to pick myself up and get on with it and fight, you know, fight the good fight, as they say. And I love it. I love the whole process. It hasn't been, believe me, the trajectory of my career has not been, you know, like a rocket going up. It's been a rocket going up and then falling to the earth. You know, and getting another rocket and lighting the fucking thing, and that'll take off, man, you know, and it'll land, and then you light another one. My life is a constant, you know, Guy Fawkes Day. Yeah, it's a constant July 4th firework display.
There is another question that I always love to ask musicians, particularly Brit musicians. And I'm just curious, when did you decide to move to this side of the pond, and why? And
well,
before
you
know, you answer, before you answer, I'll explain. I split England in 1979.
Well, you know, I came here in 72. I think the thing is that I grew up loving Errol Flynn, Marilyn Monroe, James Dean, Elvis, America, the blues, Muddy Waters, Little Richard, Otis Redding. You know, my whole, you know, education was from American movies and American music, so I was kind of biased, right? So by the time I got here, I was very young, you know, and I got here and I went, oh, my God, you know, I want to stay here. And I was in New York and very early on, and I met who would then become my wife, Pamela, who wrote I'm with the band, Confessions of a Groupie and so on. And we fell in love, and I went, you know, toured around for another year or so, went back to England, and then Silverhead broke up, my first band, and I came to Los Angeles, and I hadn't left, and that was 74.
Oh, that's quite a while ago.
It's over half my life, so, I mean, I consider myself, you know, I'm not a nationalist, but I do consider myself an American, you know. I mean, I've been here an awfully long time, and I believe in this country.
And you've mentioned some of it earlier on, you know, your musical influences. Now, it's one thing to say, I feel influenced by X, Y, and Z, but who do you actually listen to on your iPhone?
I listen to Iggy. I listen to anything that stacks. I listen to Wilson Pickett, Otis Redding. I listen to, let me just think what I've listened to in the last hour. John Lee Hooker, Skrillex. I like to work out to Skrillex. Do you know who Skrillex is?
No.
Skrillex is a very, very, very powerful electronica artist who makes ferociously aggressive music, and I love to work out to him. But predominantly on my Pandora is the Stones, the Faces, Humble Pie, Iggy, Otis Redding, Jack White, the Alabama Shakes, Aretha, Amy. I loved Amy White. I loved her. You know, what else is up there? James Brown, and James Brown. You know, I like funky, sexy music. I love Duane Allman. You know, I love Wilson Pickett. of modern artists, there are artists that I really, really, really appreciate, but not that have become regular, choices in my life. There are very few that, take over from Elvis or something.
I'm really curious. You've mentioned Iggy, which is obviously Iggy Pop. What attracts you to Iggy?
Iggy is fundamentally a force of nature more than anything else. I mean, I can get specific and I will, but I had a great pleasure of knowing him since the 70s, and we've toured together. I became fascinated by the idea of Detroit music, MC5's tough industrial, apocalyptic rock and roll anarchistic music, which he embodied and invented, which was a real statement against the conventions of society. He railed against it, wrote about it, demonstrated it in a performance, out sort of physical way, in the self-mutilation and the aggression which he displayed and still does. And anybody that sings about raw power gets my vote, and because that's what I believe rock and roll is. It's powerful music, and it's passionate music. It's not to be listened to in the background. You know, it'd be very difficult to listen to Iggy Pop in the background. You know, it's so in your face. And I love people that get in your face, especially if they've got something to say. His influences are the same as mine, in that Sunhouse and Little Richard and, Jim Morrison, even Lou Reed, they were great influences on Iggy. And we have the same frames of reference. You know, he's a balls out, hard rocking force of nature and a great lyricist.
Right. I couldn't actually see Iggy being played in elevators.
Thank God. I'd rather that, if they were, the elevators would go sideways.
Right. Yeah. People would be hitting the emergency button.
any music that's played in an elevator, I guess, would be not the kind of music I listen to. But, Iggy is, I think, the greatest rock and roll musician that America's produced. Other than the King, and Little Rich and Chuck Berry and all of that, I mean, he's up there with the pantheon of the great artists. No question about it.
Michael, I'm looking at the clock, and my producer is whining in my ear. I really want to thank you for taking time out to, waste your time talking to me.
No, it's been wonderful and very educative. I always learn something, when somebody asks me wonderful questions like you have, Simon. Thank you so much.
Michael, I wish you every success with Carnaby Street, and I do hope that we can talk again, particularly when you're on the road touring.
Absolutely, we'll make a point of it. I know that Billy, the wonderful Billy, that looks after all my stuff on this level, we'll get in touch with you, Simon, and we will do just that. I will talk to you from Madison Square Garden while performing a duet with Iggy Pop and Scarlett Johansson.
I do have a Billy story, which I'm sure you'll get a kick out of. Billy asked me a couple of weeks ago, how would I feel about, doing an interview with Michael DeBar? I went, oh, that's Murdoch.
Mm.
And he went, yeah, that's the guy.
Yeah. Well, let's not forget that I was also in ALF, and you know, working with a sock was a great challenge. But you know, people know me from various different things. It's so interesting, you know, every day, you know, somebody comes up with some thing that they've seen that you know, is at variance with what another person has seen. It's been a wonderful journey. I'm so grateful for it, and man, and you know, and the best of luck to you too. I hope your show goes forever, and we'll speak again.
Okay, you have a wonderful day.
Thank you, man.
Okay, till next time. Goodbye.
Bye bye to all your listeners. Thank you for indulging me. Bye.